Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week we explore different aspects of the world of music, including album reviews, concert reviews, and this week in music history, which is what we are bringing you today. Sorry we've been away for a few weeks. It was my fault. I was busy for weeks on end. But hopefully you've stuck with us through this little hiatus that we took. And, you know, I know we're like revamped and ready to go, and we're happy and excited.
Woo!
We're a good group. Along with me, of course, are my two wonderful co-hosts, Greg Harvey.
That's me.
And Jacob Grum.
A slightly less energetic
Woo!
Second co-host.
Give me a yeah!
Yeah.
So,
We have been having ourselves a grand old time getting prepared for the show. And I think that we're going to have a great show presented today. But before we get to the show, of course, you can help out our podcast in a number of ways. Financially speaking, you can help us out by going to our website at followthesoundpodcast.com and clicking on the Amazon banner on the right-hand side. It'll take you to Amazon. You can do all of your normal shopping. It won't cost you anything extra to go through our website, but we get a little bit of money off of everything that you purchase. Which is really nice for us. I know a bunch of people out there have still been making purchases on Amazon, thanks to you guys. But to the rest of you who aren't, it's very simple. So just go to the website, click on the Amazon banner, or you can just go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon.
Woo!
And of course, you can also help us out by finding us on all of our social media platforms, including Twitter at iFollowTheSound, and of course on Facebook at the Follow the Sound group. We are always posting videos to different things and having ourselves a good time on there in some discussions.
And stupid memes.
Yes, and stupid memes. That being said, on the social media rounds today, did anybody else see the Dave Grohl Foo Fighters fan getting brought up on stage to play Monkey Wrench?
No, I didn't see that one.
It was kind of amazing. So he brings this dude up who's got like the Kiss face on, like Gene Simmons Kiss face.
Really?
And he's just like, "Hey, what's your name, Kiss guy?" And he goes, "That's it." He's like, "I don't care." It's like, "You're Kiss guy from now on." He's like, "All right, let's play Monkey Wrench," you know? And it's like, and then the dude goes into it and he slays.
Wow.
So like, every little part that Dave normally plays, the dude just nailed it, including like some solos and stuff like that. It was fantastic.
Gives Dave Grohl a chance to stretch his legs a little bit.
Yes, after he broke it. All those years ago.
He can pop some wheelies.
Yes. So, we once again have This Week in Music History today. We like to do these episodes because they're fun and they're interesting, and we get to sort of delve into a bunch of, basically music history facts from the golden age of rock onwards up into today. But sometimes we do even go way further back than that. But, those are a bit fewer and farther between. But if we wanted to dig deeper, I'm sure we could find them. But either way, we have ourselves This Week in Music History with April 23rd through April 27th. And I think we got ourselves some really good stuff here.
Like what?
Like what?
Like
I don't
what?
Know, Jake. Start us off.
In 1969... The Ash Grove, the L.A. launchpad for everyone from Linda Ronstadt to Canheat, catches fire and burns to the ground.
Ugh.
I almost felt like we were getting into an infomercial there for a second. You know, it's like, what do you got for us? And it's like,
I just think we got all hyped up to do the show.
But wait,
here.
There's more.
And then our first story is like,
it's like, hey, this thing that you all know and love, it burned.
Everybody's favorite nightclub
to ash.
Burns to the ground.
I think we should all...
The greatest people played there.
Each
it is
us,
no more.
Each of us right now should come up with an as-seen-on-TV product, like a new product.
I can't do that.
You can't do that?
I'm thinking plunger in a can.
Plunger in a can?
That is a thing that already exists.
I see your plunger in a can.
You know what? You're right. That's the thing you shove in there, and then it blasts like the air blast.
Yep.
Damn.
Yeah. Oh man!
Well, that's why it's
see. I know.
Such a great
I know
idea.
As seen on TV, like products. I know because I watch those commercials in awe. So,
how about a shoe booty?
I don't know what that is.
Next, you're gonna tell me
it's a shoe for your shoe.
Oh,
you spend a lot of money on
that
your shoes,
sense.
Brian.
So why not have shoes for your shoes?
Right.
Is that basically like the little like covers that you put over your shoes when you go into like a clean house or
what about
something?
Like finger socks?
What about
I swear to God, I've seen that.
What about sock fingers?
We've totally derailed music history into something completely different.
So basically, you've invented sleeves.
You mean arm prisons?
Oh, man. How about we move on to 1976? For April 23rd.
Man, they tell you, you got to go to an office, man. You got to wear a collar. You got to wear a shirt with sleeves. I don't call them sleeves. I call them armed prisons, brother. Sorry, Greg. You did that to me.
Yeah. So the Ash Grove burned down to the ground.
Yes.
Damn.
Let's move on to something a little bit more exciting, I guess, at least on the happier spectrum. In 1976, the Ramones released their self-titled debut album, mostly recorded live at Plaza Studios in Manhattan over a period of just 7 days. The album is the antithesis of the epic productions that were being made by the 70s biggest stars. But with production costs of records by major artists running into excess of $500,000, $500,000 to make some of the biggest records of the time, the Ramones' debut comes in at a cost of just $6,400. $6,400 yeah. to make an album in 7 days.
I'm not surprised.
That has gone on to make millions, probably, for them.
The Ramones are definitely one of those bands that, like, they could just press record on their tape recorder and record an album. I mean, they're a punk band.
Yes.
And they play really fast. And I don't think they have anybody to impress. So.
Well, the funnier thing for me, though, is that even then, $6,400 like back then was still a pretty hefty sum for a group of guys like that. And now the cost of production has gone down to almost nothing because people can basically record everything in their closets.
But yeah, that's what I was thinking, is most of this cost is probably the studio time and then whatever production costs.
Paying the engineer and mastering and then actually producing the album or making the album, the physical copies of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just crazy. But still, I mean, $6,400, like that's dirt cheap for the time.
Well, and
but at the same time, it's still like a lot of money. Like I'm not even sure I would pay $6,400 to make.
Yeah, but you got to think that's split across a band.
That's true.
That had what, 7 members?
Yeah.
And
how many tracks were on that album anyway?
Did anybody like know? 22.
Because all of their songs were like 3 minutes, if yeah. that. So.
Well, that's a pretty fair cost considering that this really kind of made them a thing.
Yeah.
You know. That's a pretty small price to pay for fame and fortune.
Yes. And actually, I mean, I think that they were pretty well known in the music scene before they made the album. It wasn't like nowadays where it's like it's a band in their, you know, basement and then they record the album and then go out and try to shop it around. Like they yeah. were already known in the music scene.
They were like punk rock pioneers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What you find,
okay,
Jay?
Okay. So keep in mind that this is 1976, right?
Yes.
So this is before CDs.
Yes.
Right? So a double.
Vinyl records, yes.
Vinyl records, right? Everything that we've reviewed, like Pet Sounds is how many tracks?
Oh, like 10. Like eight or nine. Something like that. Yeah.
Right. So like a double album, if it's a, like, if it's a Beatles album, it might have 12 tracks.
Yeah.
Right? If it's a Pink Floyd album, it's got eight. A double album is 8 tracks for them.
Yeah.
Right? This. One LP, 14 tracks.
Wow. that's a lot of quick songs.
Clocking in so. At a minute 39.
Yep, I've got the timestamps here, and the longest song on the album, somebody take a stab at it.
I'm guessing 2.5.
I'll tell you the song,
310.
Too. Beat on the Brat.
With a baseball bat.
At 232.
Oh, wow. Yeah, jeez. Hey,
I was pretty good there.
I was off by a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Uh-oh.
You know what? Shortest track right here. Judy is a Punk, 133.
Really? Nice.
All right.
I like that a lot. Let's go ahead and jump into birthdays, though. So I like this first one. It's one of my all-time favorites. 1936, born on April 23rd, the one and only Roy Orbison is born in Vernon, Texas. Now, of course, we all know Roy Orbison's music. I mean, obviously, Pretty Woman is like, you know, his most famous just because it's been used in every single movie about a girl mm-hmm. at some point. But I've always liked the song In Dreams and Only the Lonely. Like, these are just, he wrote such great songs, and he had such a great, like, just operatic rockabilly kind of voice that floors me every time I hear those songs. Like, it's kind of hard to explain for me, because Roy Orbison has like a really special place in my heart for just songs that hit, you know? Like,
he was just a cool dude.
He was.
He's a cool guy.
And he was so much cooler when he like wore sunglasses, because when he originally started, you know, he didn't look like that good, because I mean he was like legally blind, so there is that. But then when they put the sunglasses on him, he was like, okay, he's way cooler now.
Now he's not just like looking aimlessly around the room.
Yes,
they just put some shades on that.
But I still want to review Black and White Nights, the album that he made with like all of those other great musicians back in like the late 80s. So
I'm curious. I really would like to know if there was any scandals behind Roy Orbison's life at any point. Like did he ever like a Chuck Berry moment where it was just like, Roy Orbison's the man, except for that one time?
I honestly can't think of any.
I'm just curious. I know, like, that Jake is like the scandal expert, you know?
If they existed, then I don't know about them. So, which I know a lot about the scandals that artists have
Now but. That you mention it, I mean, the guy, okay, one point of contention I have with Brian is that every time he talks about Roy Orbison, he never brings up the Traveling Wilburys.
That, okay, well, yeah, that's because that's the later stuff, and I'm just talking about him as a solo artist.
Fair enough, but it's really good stuff.
It is really good stuff, absolutely.
Yeah. But even with that, with the Traveling Wilburys supergroup that had seven people in it, and everyone loving to talk about Roy Orbison, I've never heard a story that starts out, that bastard Roy Orbison.
Yeah.
I've never heard that. Maybe being blind just does that to you, where you just don't get up to as much shit. I don't know.
No, but I mean, I guarantee you people have said that about other blind musicians.
Probably.
So Ray Charles. I know Ray Charles has had those people. Like, I'm sure Stevie Wonder has had somebody do that to him. It's like, but Roy always struck me as the kind of guy who was like super chill with everybody.
We spent all of last year talking about how many people have, like, all the unfortunate things that happened to Stevie Wonder.
Yes.
All the weird stalkers and people trying to strangle him with microphones and whatever. You know what?
I got you.
We got another birthday coming.
Let's go for it.
Okay. The year was 1947. Bassist Glenn Cornick of Jethro Tull is born in Barrow-in-Furness, Lancashire, England.
Lancashire.
Well, I've never been there, but
Lancashire.
You've never been to Barrow-in-Furness?
Well, I'm just
Furness.
Yeah, I know. I just like the name
Barrow-in-Furness,
because it literally sounds like it's like, this is the city where the Barrow is in the furnace,
next to Lancashire.
It does not sound like a location.
I always say Shire. It's not Lancashire. It's Lancashire.
Sure.
But yeah, you can. I almost wonder if these city names. I know we keep going on about stupid British names for cities, but it almost sounds to me that it's just like, hey, I'm trying to get to so-and-so's house. And they're like, oh, okay. It's like, it's over there next to the Barrow and the furnace next to Lancashire. So that's how the city got the name.
I don't know. It sounds...
That's what pops into my head. It's like, oh, they live next to that one castle, which is next to the Barrow and furnace next to Lancashire.
It doesn't sound like a location. It sounds like a tour. It sounds like we should be reading, not Jethro Tull from, it should be See Jethro Tull in Barrow-in-Furness. We're performing Barrow-in-Furness.
Near Lancashire.
Anyway.
Yeah, as long as you point out that bassist Glenn Cornick was born there, then the tour is complete.
Yes. So, we got one more birthday.
More birthdays, oh yeah.
One more.
Yes, 1952. Narada Michael Walden is born Michael Walden in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Kalamazoo.
Now that is how you name a location, England.
Yeah.
Sometime in the early 70s, Mr. Walden found a guru named Siri Chinmoy, who gave him the name Narada. That's all I can confirm. Okay? Don't ask me about his history. Don't ask me if he was into transcendental meditation. I don't know. I just know that guy gave him that name. So, shortly after leaving that weird guru, he landed the gig of a lifetime playing with Weather Report, the insane jazz band that no one has been able to, like, top. Like, everyone still talks about it because it's Weather Report. He finished out the 70s playing with Jeff Beck and Robert Fripp. In the early 80s, he began to focus on a solo career. You may recognize some of his music because it's often quoted in films. Like, you'll hear some of his stuff in Perfect, License to Kill, The Bodyguard, Mannequin, and Free Willy.
Free Willy!
His biggest hit, however, came in 1988 with Divine Emotions when it hit number one on the UK dance charts. And here's a piece of it.
Yeah, I definitely like the line, when I look at you, I go boing, boing, boing.
You know what? Lyrics, not all that great. Production value, however, excellent.
It definitely sounds like an 80s track.
You guys didn't get to see the video, but that was just cracking me up because it's all these people dancing around in like giant leather jackets and
boing,
stuff.
Boing, boing, boing.
So Narada produced that himself. And in the 90s, he turned to full-time working as a music producer and more or less quit touring. Some of his production credits actually are pretty, what's the word I'm looking for?
Legit.
Legit.
Lit.
They include Aretha Franklin's Aretha from 1986, Whitney Houston's I'm Every Woman. I'm sure you've heard that.
Yes.
The Last Temptations album, awesome. And Eddie Murphy's Put Your Mouth on Me from the album So Happy. I'm going crazy, thinking what I'm missing. Nothing. Oh. Right about now, yeah. Ooh. Just sit down closer, just let you be now. Pretty, your smile's electric, your lips look sweet enough to eat. Oh, baby, just put your mouth.
I honestly don't know what to make of that song.
I know. What the hell?
Yeah. You know, Eddie Murphy drew so much talent, like Stevie Wonder, Rick James. I think Carole King wrote a song for him. I could be wrong about that. I'm probably wrong about that. But either way, Narada is now semi-retired, still with us, and he runs a studio that he built in San Rafael, California, 1985.
Nice.
It's called Tarpan Studios. And don't, if somebody out there is listening to this and, like, you're a huge, like, you know, Narada fan, don't text me and be like, no, he's not retired. I saw him playing at NAMM last year. Like, that, he's not a, just let it go.
Yeah, just leave the guy alone, okay?
All right, let's go ahead and move on to the next day with April 24th, starting out with some of these stories. In 1961, Bob Dylan makes his recording debut when he plays harmonica on the Harry Belafonte song Calypso King. Dylan made $50 for the session.
And the rest was history.
He used that $50 to fund his entire...
His career.
He just, you know... got one of them really, really cheap studios to record in that only cost $50.
Bob Dylan once recorded an album and he didn't think it was right, so he rubbed a little dirt on it and it was all set.
I think $50 is kind of like the going rate for a
that's
harmonica.
That's pretty
right
decent
now.
In the time. Say,
that's
1961,
fair,
$50 was a pretty decent wage for you know, going in and recording a song.
Probably especially when all you're doing is playing the freaking harmonica.
Probably took him like 20 minutes. He probably just showed up. They're like, all right, here's the music. Okay.
Right, because it's not like that was a week-long session either.
No.
In 61, that's still, you're recording an entire song in a day.
Yeah.
Tracking it one person at a time.
Practiced it once, and then he played it and recorded it, and that was the end of it.
I mean, he did it hands-free. He probably just kind of did a little few like, You know, honestly, I should listen to the song before I talk smack. In all fairness.
All right, what's next?
Well, wow, this one's jumping way up to...
Way into the future.
Last year. The future that is last year. In 2017, Ed Sheeran's Shape of You was one of the biggest songs in the United States and in England, but it topped Australia's singles chart for the 14th week, breaking the record set by Coolio's Gangsta's Paradise in 1995. Ed Sheeran, Shape of You.
Goes a little something like this. All right, you've all heard the song before. We're not playing it.
You know, if I would have thought about it, I should have brought in a child xylophone. And you said it sounds a little something like this.
Ding, 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 ding.
I tell you this, I'm sure I've mentioned it before, but my wife hates Ed Sheeran with a passion.
I'm don't not even sure why.
Was that before or after the Grammys? Because a lot of women hate him from the Grammys.
When he was like first, like just getting started.
Is this back when he was like funding One Direction's career?
Oh,
Back when he was writing every One Direction song? Because he did. Like, all of their hits were written by him. And then it was
makes
like,
sense.
I mean, shoot, he got rich before he even went solo.
So, yeah. I don't know why she doesn't like him.
It's because he's a ginger.
But I don't. Yeah, that's the other thing. She's like, I don't understand these women who say that he's attractive. He's like, he's really ugly. I'm like, I don't
do
know.
Mean,
he's a dude. I'm not really paying
what
attention.
What do you mean? Don't understand. He has money.
He's
and influence, and like the musical industry is tripping over themselves to kiss his ass.
He's a rich.
What's not
musician.
Attractive about him?
I don't know. That being said, I actually do really like the song Castle on the Hill. That's a good song.
Remember,
it was really well done.
Remember when he did, when I can't sweep you off of your feet.
Oh, that one that he got sued over?
Yeah. Well, baby, I will be loving you till...
Ugh.
We're 70?
70.
But no years after that. So, yeah.
I mean, that was like the wedding song.
Yeah, it was.
Everybody out there, grab your partner and make your way out onto the dance floor. It's time for couples dance.
I'd rather do the couples dance with Put Your Mouth on Me by Eddie Murphy.
Put Your Mouth on Me by Eddie Murphy for couples dance.
All right.
Everybody find yourself two or three partners out there.
Jake, what do you got for us?
I've got a birthday.
Ooh.
1933 R&B singer. Freddie Scott is born in Providence, Rhode Island. Freddie studied medicine at University of Rhode Island, but quit to pursue music. He began as a studio singer doing background tracks for the label J&S. In 1957, he sold his first song, Baby I'm Sorry, to Ricky Nelson.
Yeah.
Ricky Nelson's debut album, and I think that was his first single.
Yes.
His plans were put on hold when he was drafted into Korea, into the Korean War, and pressed into some kind of auxiliary service that still allowed him to record music. I don't know that he was officially part of a band, but he was doing like support for USO shows and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. Really sketchy details on that. And when I looked up the story, nobody cited the source, but it all seemed to read the same and probably came from the same original article.
Yeah.
I just couldn't find the original. Anyhow. After the war, he went back to writing, and in 62, he co-wrote Hey Girl with Carole King.
Nice.
His big hit came in 1968, however, which is what everyone's heard, which is You Got What I Need.
You got what I need.
Would you say he's just a friend? Yeah, love that song.
Come on, guys. That's not... Okay, go ahead.
What?
No.
What, I'm not doing it justice? I'm probably not. Anyhow, throughout the 70s, he worked with a co-writing partner, Helen Miller, and they wrote advertising jingles, and that's kind of how he stayed afloat until he joined the oldie circuit in the 80s. And he lived long enough to see a song sampled by Biz Markie with Just a Friend. And Biz, I'm sorry, but Freddie sang it better.
Well, I was just going to say, you guys, you were singing it like the Biz Markie version, and that's why I was like, huh?
Yeah, you know, sometimes you just got to do what you got to do.
Oh, baby, you.
Anyhow, he died at age 74 in 2007. So, happy birthday, Freddie Scott.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Well, our next birthday was in the year 1942. Born in Brooklyn, New York City, none other than Barbara Streisand.
What?
And it's not Barbara, it's Barbara.
Barbara.
So, Barbara Streisand is one of these ladies that she's basically like been everywhere and done everything and accomplished pretty much everything you possibly can in the world of media.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Barbara Streisand, like, I even early on in my life, she was already like a huge, huge name, you know. Because, I mean, like, even in the 90s, I remember, like, she was like a big deal stuff. And she almost kind of had like a diva-esque, like, she didn't act like a diva, but like she was on that level of just being like, oh, like Barbara Streisand, she could just show up and play like a concert hall and it would be like a huge event. And of course, too, before the show got started, I always like to think of the her cameo in an early South Park episode as well, which for, like, I know it's kind of silly, but I mean, from my personal experience, that was probably one of the most notable points of Barbara Streisand's career, was when she was introduced to me at a young age through South Park, where she turns into the giant beast and destroys the town, and then Robert Smith from The Cure has to come and fight her.
So here's kind of the cool thing about Barbara Streisand. I mean, she's ruled Broadway, she's been in movies, she's, you know, been a recording artist and like all sorts of stuff. Technically speaking, she has the EGOT, which is the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony.
Wow.
Unfortunately, what it is that she's in like sort of the asterisk category, because one of them was given as an honorary thing as opposed to like the actual competition. And so, along with somebody else that we've talked about tonight, Harry Belafonte.
Yes.
Harry Belafonte also is in the asterisk category of the EGOT. So, but yeah, she's done a ton of stuff, and received every award you can possibly get. And she's still doing stuff. She's still acting, as far as I know. But yeah.
Yeah. My take on Barbara Streisand, I wish she'd have stayed married to Elliot Gould, because they were just so cute together. And really, America needs that kind of couple. They need a super Jew couple.
I do like the fact that she's honestly, like, most of the fame after the fact has come from, like, the hero worship in other pop culture. Mainly, like, Saturday Night Live with Michael Myers doing coffee talk.
Yeah.
And, like, we're constantly talking about Barbara Streisand. The Nanny, they were always talking about Barbara Streisand and trying to get to meet her and stuff like that. And, like, just, like, all these other weird sort of pop culture-y references. And then, of course, South Park had to go and, like, turn her into a monster.
I kind of feel like Sinatra's the same way.
Yeah. There's a lot of people who talk about Sinatra. But, you know, he's dead. Well, Barbara Streisand's still alive.
Either way.
So, yeah. But no, that's still happy birthday to Barbara Streisand. That's still, I mean, I don't, how old is she? She was born in 42, so she's old. Let me see here, actually. She's 75. So there you go.
All right.
Yay.
We can move on now?
We can move on now.
To another day.
April 25th.
April 25th. In 1970, in Nashville, James Brown records Get Up, I Feel Like Being a Sex Machine. It's the first recording with Bootsy and Catfish Collins and his new band, the JBs, who would later play with Bobby Bird and Lynn Collins under a better title of The First Family or The Last Word. However, when it comes to being a sex machine, I'll give James Brown the last word.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing.
Go ahead.
I want to get into it, man, you know.
Go ahead.
Like a sex machine, man.
Yeah.
Moving, doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Can I count it off?
Go ahead.
One, two, three, four.
on up, get up, get on up, stay on the scene, get on up, like a sex machine, get on up, get up, get on up, get up, get on up, stay on the scene, get on up, like a sex machine, get on up, get up, get on up, stay on the scene, get on up, like a sex machine, get on up, wait a minute, shake your arm, then use your palm. Stay on the scene. I like a sex machine.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's always a good song to dance to. I like that.
Yeah, no, that's just like the guitar part in there and the way it goes.
And
bump, 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 bump. Get up. Get on up. Bah.
That's the signature James Brown using every instrument as a percussion instrument.
Yeah, and it's funky.
I love it. It's such a great thing. Even from a production value, it's so nice to actually hear those elements like that. So yeah. What else we got? Oh, I'm up next. Oh, sorry. let's see here. In 1985, the musical Big River, based on Mark Twain's work and featuring a score by Roger Miller, opens on Broadway. Miller would go on to win a Tony Award for the music. That's it.
Much deserved Tony
Much
Award.
Much deserved
too.
Tony Award for Mr. Miller.
If you haven't heard Government or I Huckleberry Me, you should.
Yes.
Did you go look that up right now?
I will. No, I'm not. And then we're going to continue on with the show.
Oh, okay, okay.
Go, what's the next thing we got?
Well, in 1993, kind of an unusual one, but legendary album artist Stanley Mouse Miller, designer of Grateful Dead's Skull and Roses logo. Okay, so yeah, he might have a pretty good credit to that one. But apparently he must have done a really good job on that logo because the band financed his upcoming liver transplant. That's cool.
That's really cool.
That's really cool. The Grateful Dead paid for the guy's organ transplant, and he was the designer of their logo. So
that is pretty groovy.
And that's probably one of the, I mean, it's easily one of the most iconic band logos throughout history.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember for years seeing the skull logo and not knowing what it meant.
Yeah, I had no idea that. I mean, I always figured it was some kind of like metal band or something, especially because the name Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, man.
A tie-dyed like skull.
It's some type of weird like hard rock band or something that I just never listened to. And then when I finally heard Grateful Dead, I was just like, wait, this doesn't sound anything like their imaging. Yeah.
It's, you know, I feel the same way about the Dead Bears, too, the little bears. For a long time, I just thought they were like a cute, like a cartoon bear thing. I didn't realize that they were the Grateful Dead Bears.
Oh, nice.
You know what I'm talking about?
Weirdly enough, the Grateful Dead actually came up in story last week. I know we didn't record anything last week, but for the one day of 420, which a lot of people celebrate now, actually came to prominence because of the Grateful Dead.
Well, Brian, it is a high holiday.
It is a high holiday. But yeah, it was started by some teenagers who met at 420 after school. And then
nobody knows.
This is actually confirmed. This has been confirmed by people. And one of the guys who was one of the high schoolers ended up going and working for the Grateful Dead. And like as a roadie, and he was using like the slang terms that he grew up with. And so whenever they would do something like pass the joint around, he would say, you know, 420, because that was the joke with him and his friends and then other people in his school. And because of that, they found out about it. And then it spread amongst deadheads and then so on and so forth until finally it became super popular with everyone else.
Pass the
after high times.
I just don't believe it until I get access to a time machine. I can go back.
I'm just saying, like, I found numerous articles that actually sourced like their information, and like the mostly why people don't think that it's that is because they've heard the other myths surrounding it, like the, you know, 420 is the police code for possession of marijuana, which isn't true, and then like some of the other weird myths that have surrounded it. But yeah, it's truly just from those kids and the fact that one of them ended up working for the Grateful Dead, who then found out about it and then spread it amongst the Deadheads.
Wow.
That's it.
420.
Okay. That was last week's music history note.
Thank you.
Kind of, I guess. But
I'll relent and not argue about last week's news story.
Hopefully, though, everyone on 420 smoked responsibly. So that's all I care about. I just want everybody
I mean,
to
we're
be
a
safe.
Music podcast. Like mm-hmm. we got.
I want everybody to be safe. That's all.
We gotta understand our audience and care about our audience.
We want you all to stay alive. And
I don't
listening.
Know what irresponsible would look like, but I do know what this next. Birthday looks
okay. Go for it.
All right, that was clumsy as hell.
Yes, it was.
1923, the Velvet Bulldozer. Albert King is born Albert Nelson on a cotton plantation in Indianola, Mississippi. Albert was the half brother to B.B. King and a damn good guitar player, known for being an early adopter of the Gibson Flying V guitar.
Yeah,
and the dark toned licks that came from it. His 1967 album, Born Under a Bad Sign, is sometimes called the most studied blues album ever. But I've got some little-known facts about Albert King for you, Brian.
Go for it.
One is that Albert King actually lived in St. Louis during the 50s and briefly played drums for Jimmy Reed, because anyone who is a blues player at some point played for Jimmy Reed, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet.
Like, how many times does that guy's name come up?
Lots.
All the time. Also, Born Under a Bad Sign, written by Booker T.
That is right. I did know that,
okay.
Actually. Yeah.
And also that although Albert King changed his name to BB, or changed his last name to King after
BB,
his half-brother became famous, BB King didn't like him that much.
Ooh.
And once said that he was more of a friend than a relative. And also further on went to say that his name was King before he was famous.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
Anyway.
Hmm. But that being said, there's a lot of kings in the blues world. So, I mean, it's not like he had a monopoly on the name. But
fair enough.
I'd say he has more monopoly on BB than in anything else.
Well, sometimes Albert would put Blues Boy on his poster.
Oh, nice.
As well, so...
Okay, well, that's just a dick move.
Kind of. But I don't care, because I can go onto YouTube and I can watch him and Stevie Ray play Born Under a Bad Sign.
That is true. That is a great song.
Get my socks blown off by it.
Yep, that is true. That is true. Let's get on to April 26th now. 1969. Oh Happy Day by the Edwin Hawkins Singers enters the Hot 100 at number 72, becoming the first pure gospel song to make that chart.
Wow.
I still say the Sister Act 2 version is the best.
I couldn't tell you. But you should have seen the cheesy smile that Brian just gave us, though, after he said that.
Well, probably because, you know, my stupid brain, I'm actually thinking about it.
It was the first one that they sang as a choir, mm-hmm. in front of the rest of the school. And they had the one guy there, and he hits that really high note.
You know, I don't know if we were going to play this song for the people, but I would kind of like to hear a clip of it if possible.
I mean, like, I could play the scene. I guess it is.
Okay,
possible.
I only remember this because I went and saw Sister Act 2 with Brian and his dad.
Really?
Yes. His dad was like, "We're going to go to the drive-in tonight, Jake." And I'm like... Awesome. I'm thinking drive-in movies, right? What are they? They're like grindhouse films, okay? I'm thinking I'm going to go up there and I'm going to see like some kind of Japanese kung fu, or like, you know, kung fu transplant movie that's put in. And no. Sister Act 2.
Okay, you guys.
Was what
relax.
I got to see.
Okay.
Take it away, Whoopi.
Turn. So here's it. They start out the song singing and they suck, right? Because they're not singing it right.
Mm-hmm.
But then she like gives him a little prep talk,
which the prep talk basically comes down to her walking around and goosing everyone,
and then he starts singing it for real. That's Whoopi right there.
Wow, okay.
That's a horrible recording, though, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I just know my dad's going to be like, you better play that one note, so.
That one note.
So here's the kid again. He's singing later on. And he does this. There you go.
Gosh dang.
Whistle register.
So it's weird because that's the same song that I thought it was, but that's a way different version.
Yes, yes.
Because I was thinking like, oh, happy day.
Also, Lauryn Hill was in the choir.
Wow.
And she's actually one of the main characters of the entire movie. And she blew me away with how good of a singer she actually is.
You mean they
was,
didn't so. Just sneak her in the choir? And
that
give
was
her,
that was the
no
first
credit.
Time I had ever really heard Lauryn Hill. And I was just like, holy cow.
Wow.
Like, yeah, she's stupid talented.
Excuse me.
So there you go. That's Sister Act 2 for you.
Well, happy birthday to the Edwin...
No, that's a story,
oh,
not
I'm
a
sorry.
Birthday.
happy anniversary to the Edwin Hawkins singers.
Hitting the Hot 100 at number 72.
Yes.
All right, now let's get on to birthdays.
1938, the king of drip reverb, Dwayne Eddy, is born in Conning, New York.
Dude, no, that's
such a
awesome.
Great song.
That's awesome. That I've never heard it referred to as drip reverb.
Yeah.
Is that more of a technical term for
it? Okay, so drip reverb is usually people are talking about surf rock when they're talking about it. But if you want to know what the drip reverb sound is and how you get it, you have to buy an old Fender reverb external unit. It wasn't a pedal, it was an external unit that you plugged into between your amp and your, coming out of your amp into the reverb unit.
So I used to have a digital effects pedal, and I think the closest thing to that they called Texas reverb was what they referred to it as. So I was kind of curious, the drip reverb sound, but it makes sense. And that song is awesome. I believe, isn't that the one from Forrest Gump?
Yeah.
That they play during the running when he's running away from him in high school. And that song fits that scene so well, but I think that for me in modern reference, that's what made that song really iconic. Now, granted, being from a younger generation, it's not the original version that, it wasn't on the radio and I thought, wow, this is great. I had to get the reference from a pop culture reference.
Well, here's the interesting thing about that. When you talk about the version of it, actually with Dwayne Eddy, when his band would go and play on American Bandstand, because it was just a band and no vocals, most of the time they could convince the producers to actually let them play. So if you go on YouTube or whatever and start watching old footage of them, you'll get a live performance from Dwayne Eddy's band.
Wow.
That you wouldn't get from other people because somehow he was able to convince them to let him do it.
Nice.
Yeah, it's almost because they have music anyways in a lot of cases. It's you guys could just play, especially if you're not going to be singing over me or something. You know what? You might be onto something there, Jake. Get more gigs. Just be like, look, you host your show. We'll just play the song in the background. You just keep talking.
I got a million of them, man. I got a million of them. I still want to do the one where I get a peddler's license and put together the worst band ever made and go and stand outside of venues and play poorly and try and get clubs to pay me to go away.
Yeah, I think that's been that's everybody's dream come true.
I know, right?
Just pay me to go away.
Just pay me to go away, man. Anyway.
Next day.
April 27th. Well, I know you guys are big fans of this one, but on April 27th, 1969, Joe Cocker makes his TV debut singing Feeling All Right on The Ed Sullivan Show.
you have a chance to see him. Every night I have the strangest dream. Impressing by the way that could have been. Left you on my own arm, so it's seen. I've got to leave before I start to scream. For some left the door and took the key.
You feeling alright? Oh, oh.
I'm not feeling too good myself.
Oh, oh.
Yes, sir.
You feeling alright? Oh, oh.
I'm not feeling that good myself.
It's a good one.
Man, I love that song. I love Joe Cocker in general, so, I mean, he's always been one of my favorites. But, yeah.
It took me a long time to get Joe Cocker.
Really?
Yeah, because the only Joe Cocker I knew was, like, the sweaty old guy in a button-up shirt singing that Beatles song.
Oh, well, I mean, he's been singing that Beatles song for a long time.
I know, but that was, anytime I'd seen him, that's why. Like, I didn't know the young Joe Cocker that was, like, trying to blend, like, a Cuban rhythm section with funk.
I was hooked the second I started watching Wonder Years.
What? What'd you okay. do?
I mean, that's the first time I heard it, too.
I mean, because I was like, oh, that's such a cool voice. And I had no idea who it was for a long time after. And then I was like, man, like, he's got that voice that I love, you know?
I'm definitely going to agree with Jake here, though, that, I mean, Joe Cocker is known for the cover from the Beatles. Like, he's known for that intro to Wonder Years. But this Feeling All Right song, like, it's just really kind of a left turn from that. Like, I've heard this song a million times, right?
Mm-hmm.
I never would have guessed it was him. Because it seems too upbeat for the dude. You know, I expect something a little more. It's soulful enough, but I expect him to do something more like you said. Like, he's just sweating. And, like, he's just, like, you know, an inch away from, like, a massive heart attack on stage because he's just pushing it out. And then this song is so, like, upbeat. It's almost like, you know, like Stepping Out or Billy, you know, like some Billy Joel type stuff going on.
Mm.
I think that's the best way to put it, actually, is that this song feels more like a Billy Joel song to me. And I don't really feel like Joe Cocker in that sense. But Joe Cocker did it, so Greg Harvey can shut the hell up and just enjoy it.
Jumping up a decade, though, we got 1979. Stevie Wonder makes a surprise appearance at a Duke Ellington tribute concert held at Royce Hall on the UCLA campus. Wonder performs his Ellington encomium, Sir Duke, along with Ellington's Sea Jam Blues.
Oh, yeah.
I like that.
I really just like how you just segue right into the next story. And
I had to do it because, I mean, just it's time. It was time to move on.
I know. I'm sorry, guys.
You didn't let me go back into the old Jewish lady, though.
Sorry.
Well, let's
he's
talk
a little about sweaty. I'm afraid he's going to have a heart attack on stage, but God bless him.
Well, Stevie Wonder, that's a pretty good one. Sir Duke, great song.
Yep.
Sea Jam Blues, Ellington. I don't know that one.
Well, okay. So there is a weird theory that I've run across kind of recently, actually, about the Sir Duke song, that part of the reason the song sounds so familiar is because of this weird F major chord that's in the middle of it.
Mm.
And if you can look at the song as if there's chords that aren't being played in the rest. And if you pace that out, it looks like a Duke Ellington song, specifically Sea Jam Blues. So apparently Stevie Wonder is aware of that and decided to play those two together because it would sound friggin' awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow.
I like it. Sweet. All right, what do we got next?
Next up, we got birthdays. Birthdays! Our first birthday for April 27th comes from the year 1932. He's a guy who likes to tell you about all the hits. DJ Casey Kasem. Is born in Detroit, Michigan. His legal name, I believe, is Kamal Amen Kasem.
Yes. Kasem was his actual last name. But he was not Casey. That was just, you know.
Well, and he
made
he
it sound nice.
He falls in a similar category as like Paul Harvey and other famous radio people from that same period of time where
and you also can't forget the Wolfman back in that day too.
Oh, yeah. Well, cuz I mean he changed his name. Well, there was a thing at one point, and I mean honestly it's probably still a thing to this day, but there was definitely a period.
Oh, I know radio people who have changed their names.
Well, yeah, so. And well, radio people just change their names in general to get like a radio name. But I know that like in this instance, and like in Paul Harvey's case, they felt that their name for the time they felt was too foreign sounding, They would try and pick something that sounded a little more American. Because Paul Harvey, I mean, my last name is Harvey.
Yeah,
but Paul Harvey's like real name. Oh gosh, you know you'd have to look it up, but he thought that it sounded too foreign for an American audience to get behind.
Yeah,
which is a shame, but he comes up with a great radio name instead.
Yeah,
and everybody gets to joke about Paul Harvey being my uncle, and that never gets old. But DJ Casey Kasem, you might remember him from doing American Top 40.
Yeah,
that was his big thing.
He has such a great voice.
He did, too, and he was always happy. But those outtakes, man, the one outtake about, I'd like to wish a happy birthday to little Susie Mary Ellen, and I'd also like to tell you a story about this dead dog. A dead fucking dog? You gave me a story about a fucking dead dog? Like, we should play that clip for the people. And he's like, I'm supposed to transition from birthdays into a story about a goddamn dead dog?
Wow.
But in the Casey Kasem voice, of course.
Wow, this is going to be an awkward transition from that to this. But
okay.
1947, Ann Peebles is born in St. Louis, Missouri. Of course, she begins singing in the choir of her father's church, and in her teen years formed a gospel act known as the Peebles Choir. Being the seventh of 11 children, her family had plenty of voices to fill the choir with. After her family's choir opened for Sam Cooke, she decided that the stage was where she belonged and lived on stage until 2012 when a stroke forced her into retirement. So, yeah. I'm just saying. She had an impressive career, so. But the funny thing, though, is that, you know, she did the transition from gospel to pop, and like that's a big no-no. You're never supposed to do that back in the day. So, but Sam did it, so she did it too. That's why.
Probably worked out for her fairly well.
Yeah, I was kind of curious because I remembered like a couple of samples of her, so I looked her up on who sampled. She's been sampled 70 times.
Wow.
Which is a lot more than I would have expected.
Yeah, that's pretty, yeah. That's
it
crazy.
Doesn't like put her up there with like James Brown, who's in like the 6,000s, but
true.
You know, hey.
That's understandable, though.
Fair enough.
All right. What do we got next to,
we got
to
one
close
more
out the show?
1959, Sheena Easton is born. Sheena Shirley Orr in Glasgow, Scotland, the youngest of six children. And the apple of Scotland's eye. I don't know. I've got nothing on this.
Craig Ferguson.
I just like Sheena Easton's music.
Yeah, no, she's definitely had a string of hits. So, I mean, I don't really know what else I can say about her, though.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with her myself. I mean, like, what would I know her from? What's her big thing?
For Your Eyes Only.
For Your Eyes Only.
Yeah, that was the James Bond theme.
Well.
She had Strut, You Got the Look. I mean, You Got the Looks, I mean, got to be one of her biggest hits.
You Got the Look. Is that it? That
the one? Arms of Orion with Prince, The Lover in Me.
Was it
What Comes Naturally?
Was that like the 80s song, You Got the Look?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Right? Is that the one I was singing? You've got the look, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's
you've
it,
got
yeah.
The look, you've got the look.
Yeah, with Prince.
Okay, all right. Well, see, you know, and that's one of the things I appreciate about this show is that even I learn stuff every single time we do a show. Because, I mean, I've heard her music. I didn't know who Sheena Easton was. Now I do.
Yep.
I'd like to be the audience advocate here to say, who's that? Tell us more.
Yeah.
I will say this about Sheena Easton. I like the way her career worked, where before she would start to tour in a new market, she would do a feature with someone, right? Like, before she came back over for a second U.S. tour after she'd been gone for 10 years, she did a song with Kenny Rogers.
Yeah.
And I was like, boom. And then she would do
a lot of her stuff was like with a feat, you know, she was either featured with someone else or she did a feature with some, like, you know, worked with other artists.
Works well with others.
Yeah. And I mean, and that still continues to this day. That's pretty standard practice.
Yeah. And then like in the 90s, it's like, look, dance music isn't selling anywhere but like in South Africa. So she's like, okay, well, I'll do a song with someone from Mexico. And then we'll put that out and it'll hit the Latin circuit and I'll go down there.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh.
But yeah. But that brings us to the close
find an audience.
Of
Yay.
The show.
We made it.
We made it in just under an hour, so look at that.
Wow.
Which is pretty good. Remember, if you want to help out the show, go to our website, followthesoundpodcast.com, and click on the Amazon banner, or go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Do all that shopping. And we get a little bit of money. It won't cost you anything extra. Also, find us on the social media sites, on Facebook for the Follow the Sound group, and on Twitter at IFollowTheSound. You know, hit us up. Share some stuff with us. We're always looking for some new music or some random history facts or something like that. We're always good for that. So find us on any of the social media platforms, and we will gladly interact with you. I have been your host, Brian Kroc. Along with me, of course, has been Greg Harvey.
Yes, that is I.
And Jacob Crum.
I never felt until I looked at you.
Well, okay. But remember, folks, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.